All right. Here we go. All right, so just to start off, I thought we'll cut, kind of your background before you came to Swarthmore. So if you want to just talk a little bit
Yeah,
maybe
okay,
about like
real quick.
college
Did I send
to
you a
start off
copy
with.
of my CV?
A little bit, yeah, you did
Yeah,
send me that.
okay, I'll talk just
So.
briefly. I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio. Went to Reed College in 1955, graduated in 59, majored in history. Went to graduate school in anthropology at the University of Washington in Seattle. Started that in 59 and completed the PhD in 64. In social or cultural anthropology, which is my main area of anthropology, in the United States and Great Britain and all of the outliers of Great Britain, like Ireland and Australia, virtually all PhD dissertations in anthropology are based on field work. So I did my field work in Thailand. Okay. Then came back, say completed in 64. My first job was at Carleton College, 64 to 66. Then the opportunity arose to come to Swarthmore for the academic year 66, 67. So I came there and retired in 09.
All right. And so what work were you doing at Carleton?
As a joint sociology anthropology department at Carleton, like it is at Swarthmore, I was
Okay.
a full-time anthropologist in the joint sociology anthropology department.
Okay. So you just jumped right in there.
Yeah, just jumped right in
And how'd you end up switching to Swarthmore so quickly?
there. That was sort of fortuitous. I really liked it at Carleton. In fact, had I not gone to Reed, Carleton is where I would have gone to college. I was not on the job market. I was not looking for a job. As I think I mentioned before, or maybe you mentioned, Swarthmore's Department of Sociology and Anthropology wasn't founded until the academic year 65, 66. Now, why, for a school of Swarthmore's caliber and nature, there was no sociology and anthropology prior to that is a very interesting question, but I think it's not what we're talking about. Although you can read my history of the first 10 years of the department, I talk about it there. The founder of the department, a sociologist in the first chair named Lee Bramson, one of his major first jobs was to recruit more faculty. And he was working through his colleague, old boy net. And he somehow, I don't know where, he somehow got my name and he got in touch with me and asked if I'd be interested in being considered. I came for an interview, and the combination of how impressed I was with Lee Bramson and my expectation that I would really like to work with him and work under his mentorship, and the opportunity that early in my career to get in on the founding of a new department at a school of Swarthmore's nature and caliber, be the first anthropologist at Swarthmore, that persuaded me to leave a place where I was quite happy and quite content. Yeah.
So, coming to Swarthmore, how much work did you have to do for founding the anthropology department?
A
Because
lot, but it was very, for those of us who are involved in that, you know the name John Van Til? Yeah. Lee Bramson was there by himself in 65, 66. The next year it was Lee and John and me. And we were sort of the three founders. I mean, Lee was the founder, but we were the triumvirate. And John and I became very close friends and good working colleagues. And that's the way it was in the department for several years. And there was an awful lot of stuff to do, recruiting new faculty members, curriculum development. The department was just awash with students back then. There had been a lot of student agitation for having sociology and anthropology at Swarthmore before the decision was taken to have it. So it was sort of like the barbarians massed at the gates and pounding on the gates, and when the gates fell down, they all rushed in. And we were just awash with students. And, but it was a very positive, exciting period. The morale in the department was very good. We all really enjoyed it a lot.
So it was just the three of y'all handling that?
Well, the mandate for the, in a typical Swarthmore fashion, when, of course, you know who Courtney Smith was, when he decided, all right, it's time for us to give serious consideration to having sociology and anthropology at Swarthmore, and if he felt that, you can take it for granted that the Board of Managers was on board, he set up a Blue Ribbon Committee of mainly social scientists. Okay. You see, to decide what kind of a program would make good sense for Swarthmore and to make recommendations for how to implement such a program. So that committee worked for, I don't know, a year, maybe longer, and recommended a program. And the size of the department they recommended was 5 people, 3 sociologists and 2 anthropologists. but within, Lee was on board 65, 66. By 1970, there were 8 FTEs mm-hmm. in the department. And the department has been at a very hard to, you wouldn't think with a number less than 10, it would be hard to count. But it's not entirely unambiguous. And that's been about 7 or 8 FTEs has been about the size of the department since mm-hmm. then. So, divided between the 2 disciplines.
So it got up to size pretty quickly there.
Yeah. That was the intention, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, the intention was to spend a few years bringing the department up to strength and get its curriculum established. So, and that intention was fulfilled. But that's the committee that recommended the department, that wrote the report, that's what they were expecting.
And then so in 1968-1969, you get involved with the formation of Black Studies.
Yeah, I didn't get so much get involved with the formation of Black Studies okay. then. It was the admissions office.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, but those things were, of course, interrelated. Let me tell you how that played in my life. When sure. I came back to Swarthmore in the fall semester of 1968, you know where Crummel Edge is?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we lived down
there. Yeah, those little houses.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, the faculty. There's 2 blocks of faculty housing mm-hmm. down there in the woods. My wife and I and our young son, Josh, you know, lived there. And I was all back gung-ho in the planning, building a new department. And I knew all the stuff that was going on campus.
And this is after you had come back from Thailand?
Yes, this was the fall of 68. I mean, everybody knew what was going on. There was Frank Pearson's Black Studies Curriculum Committee was in operation working on developing okay. a Black Studies program. The questions of the issues which became so familiar had already surfaced. Number of Black students, number of Black faculty, number of Black administrators. You know, why are the only Black employees on campus janitors? You know, all this stuff was in the air and was being worked on and attended to extensively mm-hmm. by the college, the administration and the faculty, with students involved, especially Black students, CS involved. And I was sort of a spectator for it. I wasn't involved in any of this work, although some of the people who were involved in it I knew quite well, like John Van Til was very involved in it. So I sort of knew what was going on. then at the beginning of the spring semester 09, I don't remember the exact dates, but it was in January, the admissions office sit-in occurred. You probably mm-hmm. know what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it seemed like what I'm about to tell you is not literally true, but it seems sort of like it was. You know, the faculty was in continuous session. Of course, that was not true. But there would maybe be 15, 20 hours a week of faculty meetings.
And what were those like?
I'll get around to that in a
okay.
minute. Clothier, the inside of Clothier then looked like what you would expect it to look like from the outside now.
Yeah.
It was a huge church auditorium, seated 1,000, 1,200 people. The whole student body was in there except for Black students because they were in the admissions office.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was, you know, it wasn't full-time like that, and there were committees and one thing and another. And as I say, the faculty meetings were in, there was an awful lot of faculty time when every day the faculty was meeting, sometimes for 2, 3, 4 hours. And everybody recognized, including especially Courtney Smith, the administrators who led the college, that the administration and the faculty had to be in conversation with SAS, you see. And of course, SAS wanted to be in conversation with the appropriate parties and bodies and offices in the college. And he had been there. He had been a lot of this conversation the previous fall. But with the black students, you know, occupying the admissions office, and the whole faculty that met over in the biology building then, how was this going to occur? So administration decided that there would be a liaison committee of faculty members, and CS members that would manage the communication between the faculty and administration on the one hand and CS on the other hand. Okay? Somehow, it was decided that I would, not by me, I didn't even know there was going to be such a committee. Hmm. I didn't seek any involvement in any of this kind of stuff. It was decided that I would be one of the faculty members on this committee. The first I learned about that was when I heard my name mentioned by Courtney Smith in a faculty meeting. In fact, I think I had dozed off a little. And hearing Courtney Smith mention my name is what woke me up, and I didn't know for a few minutes what the hell was going on that had to do with me. So this committee came into existence, and the committee... do you know who Osmaram Legesse was? Mm-hmm. Osmaram and I were very close friends. He was so invaluable to the college, not because of official positions he held, but because he's such a wise, learned, multicultural, compassionate, caring person. He's so much, no single person at Swarthmore back then helped as much as Osmaram did, helped the college as much as Osmaram did to negotiate this stormy period as well as it did. But it was behind the scenes, brokering, conversing with people, sharing his ideas. And his personality, to know Osmaram is to love him. Mm. Osmaram is Eritrean by birth, Harvard anthropology PhD. Even that early in his career, he was a distinguished anthropologist. East African pastoral nomads was his work back then. okay, so this committee came into existence, and in fact, where we met was at the house I was living in down on Grummel Edge, just because that was not because of me, but just because that, you know, meetings were mainly in the evening, and that was the closest comfortable place, and no other faculty home was as close as that. And most evenings we would be down there, you know, the faculty members who were on the committee, and three or four or five CS students. You see, and it was back and forth between SAS, but through the committee, between SAS on the one hand and the faculty administration on the other. And initially and always, the official purpose of the committee was to be liaison, communication. But what happened de facto was it wasn't possible just to do communication. In deciding how and what's going to be communicated, you configure the content of the negotiations. So the committee actually became very involved in the negotiations. Mm-hmm. Now, this went on for, I don't remember exactly how long the black students were in the admissions office before Courtney Smith passed away. What was it, 10 days, something like that, 12 days?
Something like that.
Yeah. This committee was in operation. The faculty was continuous meeting. The students were meeting. Student council was passing proclamations. Frankly, white student activists were attempting to co-opt the black student activists, and the black student activists were having none of it. You see, I mean, they knew exactly what was going on. One of the expressions that developed back then is among the CS students is we don't want to be part of Whitey's liberal arts education, you see. But also the black students, he had tremendous visibility and within the student body, tremendous legitimacy. And white activists wanted to cash in on that. But the black students didn't, there was no antagonism, but the black students didn't cozy up. All right, so these negotiations went on for however long, a week, 10 days. And there was give and movement on both sides. And the administration, and I think especially Courtney Smith, decided that he wanted a summation, that this was destroying the life of the college. Academic life could not go on in the college while all this was happening, and where people's emotions and time were so much captured by this, that the college was not going to be able to operate as a college if this continued. So the word came to our committee a week, 10 days in, that Courtney Smith wanted a summation of where things stood as far as CS on the one hand and the faculty administration on the other hand actually significantly getting together, you know, finding some common ground. So the committee was charged to prepare a report, Ray, that question. And Courtney Smith said he wanted it the moment it was prepared. It was prepared. Okay, so we got input from the faculty. Here's where we are. The faculty had moved. And here's what we've done. Here's what we have in prospect. We got input from CS. Here's what we've done. Here's what we say. Here's what we have in prospect. And the committee sort of tallied it up. And the upshot was bleak, that the gulf between the faculty administration on the one hand and CS on the other seemed to be very, very wide and very, very deep indeed. And neither side then acted as if they were prepared to move any further. Okay? Courtney Smith said he needed to hear the report, whatever the date was. It was the date he died, because there's some deliberations were going to be taken within the administration and the board of managers. And we told him, yeah, we can probably have it for you the previous day or evening. And he said, whatever time it's finished, bring it to my office. Well, it wasn't finished till midnight or 1 in the morning. I hand-carried it up to his office. Now, needless to say, the office was locked and nobody was in the office. But happily, I was able to find a janitor in Paris who let me in. And I put that report with its extremely bleak summation and prognosis on his desk. So when he came in the next morning, an hour before he was stricken, I think that report was on his desk. I'm not sure. I mean, because his, even if it was, I'm not sure he saw it. But it could be his office staff came in before he did and organized his work for him. He may never have seen it. Okay. Yeah. And then that morning he came in and was stricken with a heart attack in his office and died literally in his office. And that was like a 2x4 blow to the base of the college's collective skull. I mean, it was just a stunning thing. and just about immediately that day, CS left the admissions office and issued a conciliatory statement, prominent in which was praise of Courtney Smith. You see, the statement, you've probably seen a copy of the statement. It must be in the papers somewhere.
Yes.
Yeah. there was no antagonism, no anger in the statement. And following that, both sides, CS on the one side, faculty administration on the other, rededicated themselves to working together, and progress was made. And a lot of the work that was done was work on fashioning a Black Studies program. See? And the first iteration of that was what Frank Pearson's BSCC, Black Studies Curriculum Committee, brought out and was approved by the faculty, I think, in 69. And here, there's a tremendous amount of the correspondence and memos and whatnot, the ideas that were being batted about as to both the content of the program and the administrative structure of the program, but also the staffing of the program. You see, there's a tremendous amount of stuff in here about that. In the faculty, I think it was the fall of 69, did approve what that committee recommended. And that committee recommended it, I think, with the more or less qualified, the committee's recommendations had the more or less qualified support of SAS. But I think it was recognized by everybody, SAS, the faculty, the administration, that because the resources, especially the faculty resources, were so scanty for Black Studies, it's worth more than that what could be implemented and actually put out there to be a part of students' programs of study was sparse, not all that substantial, nowhere near as substantial and as good as what the college wanted. Mm-hmm. So then the Black Studies Committee was instructed to keep working on this, and I don't remember exactly how or why this happened. Frank Pearson may just have decided, I mean, he'd put, by the time he stopped being chair of that committee, he had put no less than 3 very hard-working years into that committee work. This is in addition to his regular full-time responsibilities as a professor of economics and chair of the economics department, you see. So he probably said, okay, I paid my dues, let somebody else do it. And they asked me to do it. It's never been clear to me why they asked me to do it. I've never worked in the area of Black Studies. Mm-hmm. However, the 2 things I can think of that may have conduced to asking me to chair that committee, and I was not tenured then, was one, I had all of this heavy involvement in the admissions office stuff and what was going on around it, you see, and the issues that interfaced with. And second, as an anthropologist, I know how to design a program of study, the purpose of which is to learn about a culture and the life ways of people, you see. I do know. Anthropology is not a uniquely good, but a good disciplinary choice for the person who's going to head up that exercise. Now, Frank Pearson, I'm certain, would have, had he been willing to continue, would have done an excellent job.
And not only that, but the anthropology department had just recently been built up itself.
Yeah. And also, where curricular offerings more or less directly relevant to what people were coming to understand that Swarthmore intended to mean by Black Studies. There's more of this in the socio-anthro department than any other department in the college at the time. Of course, I could have asked John Van Til. I mean, race and ethnic relations was one of his fields in sociology, you see. It was never clear to me. The one further thing I'll say in this connection, John, is the work I did on the liaison committee, my involvement in the liaison committee, and then subsequently my involvement in the Black Studies Committee, formulating what I think can fairly be represented as the college's first substantive Black Studies program, what Frank Pearson's committee recommended out couldn't be substantive because the resources for having a substantive program weren't there. I still think of those 2 committee chores as the best, most fulfilling committee work I've ever done at Swarthmore College. And a major reason for that, and most of the committee work I've done at Swarthmore College has been, the committees came to be staffed in part by students, has involved students. The SAS students on these 2 committees did wonderfully. They were wonderful. Needless to say, there was tension. There was strong disagreement. But they were just awfully good. Awfully good.
Yeah.
And the faculty members were very dedicated, and these were, you know, attention, a lot of work, a lot more, frankly, faculty, most faculty members at Swarthmore don't intend. We all serve on committees, but no one tends to, most committees you serve on, you don't intend to spend much time at all on them. This was, both of these committees were very, very time consuming while they were in operation. And the faculty members just did superbly, I thought. Now, this file is a vast amount of the stuff that was going on in the committee, what was being thought about, the differences of viewpoint, the alternative ways of trying to conceptualize Black Study for Swarthmore in all of its dimensions, content, structure, staffing. There's an awful lot of information in these two files about how Frank Pearson's committee thought about that and how the subsequent committee thought about that. So.
And so what were the discussions like deciding what Black Studies would be consisted of?
An awful lot of different issues surface, but and this interfaces with, of course, Swarthmore College is not the only college in the country mm-hmm. that all of a sudden was trying to get up to speed in one heck of a big hurry on having an academically good quality Black Studies program taught substantially, if not wholly, by Black faculty members and having a lot more Black students mm-hmm. than they previously had had, and having more Black administrators. Mm. You say, everybody, especially all the good colleges, all the colleges that Swarthmore likes to compare itself to, you see, we're just wearing out horse flesh, trying to get down that road in a hurry, you see. And one of the major issues is, where are the faculty members going to come from? I don't have specific statistics to quote to you, but so few qualified Black faculty members in the United States in 1972. You know, nowhere near enough to go around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was just one of the ineluctable parameters of the situation. The other had to do with, where are you going to get Black students? A statistic I remember in one of those years, 1970, 71, 72, and it's much harder to get Black male students and Black female students. Mm. I mean, when I say get them, I mean find them that would be academically qualified for Swarthmore. And for a long, long time, I don't know if this is still holding up, but the ratio of female to male in the Black student body was 2-1 female to male.
Right.
Which created, since almost without exception, the Black students didn't want to date except among themselves. And that created real problems for the women.
Hmm.
You see? That they couldn't have a kind of social life they wanted to have. One of those years, 70, 71, 72, of Black high school graduates in the United States, the number who scored 1,200 or higher on their SATs was only 200. Mm. Hmm. I don't know what SAT scores are. They're scoring differently now. But back then, I think the highest you could get was 1,500 or 1,600. You see, now 1,200 in the nationwide picture was a good score. It was significantly above average. But Swarthmore's average SATs were around 1,400. You see, and the admissions people felt, and I think probably correctly, that someone with an SAT of 1,200 does not have a good prospect for succeeding at Swarthmore. You see. And there were anyhow 2, 3, 4 dozen schools like Swarthmore, you know, that wanted 20-30% of these Black males, half of whom probably shouldn't have been admitted in the first place. You see, not because it would have been unfair to them, finally, that they wouldn't have had a good chance of succeeding, no matter how much support they got. So, I mean, these were, you know, the startup, these were major startup issues. Then as regards the content of the program nationwide, there are all sorts of different models being proposed, but one cleavage which separated a lot of the models is Black Studies going to be fundamentally an academic program, or is it going to be something else housed by and sponsored by colleges, such as consciousness-raising program for Black students? You see, and a lot of American colleges and universities, including some very, very respectable ones, such as in the Ivy League, toyed very seriously and even experimented with the latter model. You see. Now, and of course this was discussed in the committee. Probably the single person, you know who Catherine Morgan was? Yeah. She had vast stature and was held in very affectionate regard by all the Black students on campus. Catherine Morgan was probably the main person who decided which, who determined which way the stick was going to float on that issue. And Catherine Morgan just made no bones that a program, a Black Studies program at Swarthmore College, with which she could conscientiously be associated, was going to be an academically respectable program. So that's the way it went. Now, that committee produced a report.
Okay.
It's not in these documents.
Okay.
But you should certainly be able to get it. Okay. It may be at the Black Culture. People can do a paper chase for you, and you really need to see that report, because that report is the distillate of all of this discussion that went on for a period of a year, year and a half, maybe 2 years.
And what would the title of the report be, roughly?
It was 1972-73, a Black Studies program for Swarthmore. Okay. And on the front page, it has the membership of the committee. That was the report that was presented to the faculty. You see, it was like the report that was presented to the faculty in 1962 or whenever by the committee that was mandated to recommend a socio-anthro department. The report of our committee was exactly coordinate to that report. Here's why we think we should have Black Study. Here's the kind of Black Studies program we think makes good sense for Swarthmore. Here are recommendations as to how to go about implementing it. You see, how about getting it started and implementing it? And the faculty approved the report. That was no surprise, but I mean, not necessarily because the report was so great, although I haven't seen the report for 40 years, but my guess is it was a good report. But the faculty was on board for having a substantive Black Studies program at Swarthmore. And then the question of then getting it implemented became... And staffing and getting a director of Black Studies. You know who Clem Cottingham was? Yeah, he was the first director of Black Studies, I think. And then, of course, there was the question. Everyone on the committee agreed that in the conceptualization, formulation, implementation of a Black Studies program for Swarthmore, the Black perspective, he has to be prominently represented, bordering on paramount. But that's very general. First of all, what is the Black perspective? I mean, there are millions and millions of Black people in the United States, and to find a perspective that is shared by most or almost all of them, you have to climb up to such a high level of generality, it's not going to have much specific content. See? and then second, there was the question, which is subspecies of a very big, interesting, and important question all over the academic world: who's qualified to embody the who embodies this? Who can embody this perspective? More specifically, do you have to be black to embody this perspective? Okay. That's a very close first cousin to a question which pops up in the life of every anthropologist who does field work in another culture. Do I have to be Thai to develop a useful understanding of aspects of Thai culture? Mm-hmm. It's the same question. It's a question which pops up whenever we're interested in trying to learn about the cultural other. You know, can one learn significant, important, interesting, worthwhile things about the cultural other? So, Swarthmore College clearly thinks the answer is yes. If we want to sit down with the college catalog, exclusive of the natural sciences, I'd bet a month's salary against a Krispy Kreme donut that two-thirds of the courses that are offered in the divisions of humanities and social sciences importantly involve materials on the cultural other. The same. Mm-hmm. So if you don't think the answer to this question is yes, then I have a question for you. What the hell are you doing at Swarthmore College? You know, I mean, why don't you relinquish the... Since Swarthmore College curriculum is so extensively and heavily and deeply devoted to that, if you don't think that this is a the success in this endeavor, anyone who doesn't think that success in this endeavor is possible, Swarthmore College is not the place for them to go to school. Because Swarthmore's curriculum is very heavily mortgaged to the conviction that, yes, a significant amount of success with this endeavor is possible. But this is widely and sometimes hotly debated all over the academic world, this issue, not just specifically with reference to who's qualified to learn about and teach about the black perspectives, but the perspective of any cultural other.
But even despite that, it was still encouraged that it should predominantly be black professors that comprise the black
Studies department. Yeah, and there were partly because they, of course, being black, they were black. And it had lived the experiences of black Americans, which are much more heterogeneous than expressions like black perspective would suggest. See, it's just like the perspectives of Jewish Americans or Catholic Americans, you know, are very heterogeneous. Mm-hmm. Partly for role modeling reasons, that the black students felt, and a lot of people thought, including me, thought this was very sensible, that there's something fundamentally wrong with our education at Swarthmore if 98% of the black adults we see on campus in the employ of college or janitors or working on the dish belt, you know, down on the dining hall or in some menial capacity.
And was that something that was addressed much or dealt with?
It was talked about a lot. Mm-hmm. But you see, dealing with it, you have to find qualified black faculty members, qualified black administrators. And then there's a question of, well, how many should there be? And this reduces to how many angels can stand on the head of a pin. You know, I mean, certainly more than we have. I think in looking through these papers, I think it was felt that, say, by the mid or late 1970s, you have 6 to 8 would be is less than the college wanted to have, but it would represent success. Mm-hmm. But then there was also the question of what recruitment, would there have to be special recruitment practice? Because when you think about it for a minute, Swarthmore is a very small college with small departments. And positions in departments whose subject matter is relevant to black studies are only going to come open once in a coon's age. So if you wait for natural processes like retirement, not getting tenure, a Swarthmore faculty member voluntarily leaving the faculty to open up a black studies related slot, it's going to be awful slow. Mm-hmm. Awful slow. So should But this was always the way the college did its hiring, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Should special efforts be made? And if so, what form should they take, you see?
And was there strong resistance to taking special efforts?
Well, there's some materials in these files about that. I wouldn't say resistance.
Okay.
I would say objection, some of which I thought was reasoned well, although I personally didn't agree with it. But I could see where they were coming from. You see, in the issue which hovers around us, academic standards, mm-hmm. You mess around too much with the recruitment process, you qualify academic standards in at least two very important ways. One is you get people who just professionally aren't good enough. They shouldn't be at Swarthmore.
Mm-hmm.
They're not the cream of the crop. Okay? And second, you get imbalances within departments and between departments.
Mm.
You see? I mean, the history department, you're now dallying with the history department. It has its curriculum, which is the discipline of history is the history department and its judgment, which has emerged and evolved over a century and a half, as the history department thinks it should be presented in its curriculum. This is a very considered, reasoned judgment. It's been approved by the provost. You see, the history department doesn't operate autonomously. They're accountable to the administration. Okay, how much can you mess with that?
Yeah.
You see? There's no easy, clear-cut resolutions to these questions. I mean, no easy, clear-cut resolutions that measure up.
And how much was setting the Black Studies curriculum tied to either what professors were currently available or what professors the college thought they could make
available? It was tied to this. Here's how that plays, John. The Department of Sociology and Anthropology, in whose founding I was heavily involved, was actually invented twice. Mm. One on a higher level of generality and one much more specifically. The first invention was the committee, which Courtney Smith set up to recommend the department, and their report, that report, on a high level of generality, invented what a sociology and anthropology department at Swarthmore should look like. Then 4, 5, 6 of us got there, and working within these guidelines, we specifically invented the department. You see,
mm-hmm.
They didn't try to. The Courtney Smith's committee didn't try to name the courses that the department mm-hmm. should offer, what reading should be in them, what the assigned work should consist of. That's what the faculty members who are there do. Of course accountable to the administration, but that's what the faculty members do. So ditto with Black Studies. When you get your hands on that report that the committee in which I was involved produced that recommended the substantive Black Studies program, you'll see, yes, a substantive Black Studies program is invented here, and one that grows out of and is continuous with what Frank Pearson's group did. But then once a Black Studies faculty was on the ground, much more specifically, they reinvented. And this is appropriate,
mm-hmm.
you see. Of course, in close consultation with colleagues and other departments, always accountable to the provost. They're not freelancing it. But they reinvented the department. That's with new programs, that's a healthy that's a good model. You see, for the people on the committee that recommends the program to try to specify the program down to the dotting of the I's and the crossing of the T's when they don't even know who's going to be teaching in the program is just an exercise in utter folly. It's just bound to screw up.
So at the beginning, like in 1969, 1970, when the discussions were just getting going about founding the Black Studies program, at least from your interactions, at that point, what were like the end goals for SEEM?
Well, I don't think anyone who was involved in this planning process supposed that end goals were envisioned. But they aren't for any of the established departments at Swarthmore either. I mean, if you ask me today, what goals would you like for the Department of Sociology and Anthropology for 20 years down the road, I'd laugh in your face. You see, I don't know who's going to be here. I don't know what developments there are going to be in the field. You know, I don't know what the disciplines are going to look like then with any particularity. I mean, to try to answer that question, I mean, if you want to sit around and schmooze about that, that's fine. You know, I enjoy bull sessions as much as the next person. But to try to answer that question prescriptively by writing an administrative brief mandate, which dictates that that's where we're going, that's stupid.
That's so mostly to define it as a program or a major and to let it develop in its natural course.
Yeah, and it's expected, of course, as it is for all of the disciplinary programs at Swarthmore, the departments. See, Black Studies has never been a department at Swarthmore. Mm. In that respect, it is the first of a new breed of programs, interdisciplinary programs, that became much more numerous beginning some years later, like Asian Studies, in which I was heavily involved, Latin American Studies, Interpretation Studies, Francophone Studies, all these studies, Women and Gender Studies, or whatever they call it, mm-hmm. You see. These programs do not have departments. They're staffed wholly by faculty members who have appointments in regular departments. Like, it's easy to imagine that for Black Studies, you have a historian or two, you have a sociologist, you have an anthropologist, you have someone from literature.
And was it ever envisioned that Black Studies would be its own department?
I don't remember hearing about it. But it's never been envisioned that any of these would be departments. You see, the idea is that when I came to Swarthmore, the faculty and the curriculum was virtually entirely disciplinary. The one significant except the departments corresponded to disciplines. You see, physics, English, history, political science, classics. The one significant exception to that, there was a somewhat interdisciplinary program, not major, I think, in international relations. And when you read especially the stuff in the Frank Pearson Black Studies Curriculum Committee period, they look closely at that as a more or less direct model for how the Black Studies program should be organized and administered. You see? And then later on, all of these new programs arose, and Swarthmore became less disciplinary. The curriculum, it still remained predominantly disciplinary, but it became less, it became more interdisciplinary in significant part, but not in whole, because of all of these programs which are interdisciplinary. Go look, when you get back to Swarthmore, you can probably do it online now, I'm sure. Just get the college catalog and go to any one of these programs and look at how many different department lodgings are represented among its faculty roster.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Yeah. And when y'all were, especially the faculty, founding the Black Studies Department, how much of it was seen as something to work towards progress at Swarthmore, and how much of it was also seen as a goal to work towards something on a national level?
Yeah, is that a consideration?
Making progress in, like, cultural relations between Blacks and whites?
Well, I mean, somewhere up front of the catalog, when the reader is being slathered with abstract mission statement, you'll find phrasing like, Swarthmore College wants to turn out useful citizens. It's expected the whole curriculum will do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, will contribute to that. You see, you know, after you graduate from Swarthmore, there's going to be an awful lot of continuity between the postgraduate John and the pre-Swarthmore John. You see, I mean, mm-hmm. you brought a definite persona, and had you decided not to go to Swarthmore but go someplace else, I have no doubt you would have gotten a real good education. He had a fine experience, come out equipped, you know, for wonderful life opportunities, make a constructive contribution to our society. How can you say specifically, what Swarthmore's contribution to this is?
Mm-hmm.
You see?
I mean, so the main focus was to do what you can, which was at Swarthmore.
Well, the education, I mean, being well educated about the realities of black people in American society, everything else being equal, should equip you better to live and work constructively with the kind of issues that attend that.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
But I, just speaking for myself, I wouldn't want to try to go beyond that. As far as influencing what else goes on in the academic world, Swarthmore, insofar as Swarthmore does that, you know, I think it doesn't do it to a great extent, because neither Swarthmore College nor by far the vaster part of the rest of the academic world think that Swarthmore College should be a model for the American academic world. Swarthmore College is very unusual, and what's distinctive and wonderful about it is ineluctably tied to that unusualness. You see, that you're not going to go, you know, what's going on at Swarthmore College is not in any useful specific sense going to provide models for what goes on at a public state university.
Mm-hmm.
You see, what goes on at a public state university may be just fine.
And do you think Swarthmore felt any responsibility because of that to take the lead with this?
Well, how would one take the lead? What does it mean to take the lead?
I guess I'd be one of the first schools establishing a Black Studies program.
Well, it wasn't one of the first. I mean, it was in the herd.
Yeah.
You see? But the reason that there was such a herd effect here was, frankly, I mean, a lot of groundwork had been laid in the 50s and especially in the 60s of the schools becoming aware that, hey, this is a major lacuna. There's a number of lacunae, you know, that we don't have a Black Studies program. That we don't have Black faculty members, we don't have any Black students, and people were concerned with that and whatnot. But it was Black student activism that produced the herd effect.
Mm.
And Black student activism was everywhere. So, and one of the questions that was asked, well, since so much had been done, and frankly a whole lot of significant substantive progress had been made before the admissions office sit-in. Now, where I'm going now is conjectural history, which is a very steep and very slippery slope. You know, you put your foot on that slope, you're likely to be taking an ass over tea kettle tumble before very long. Was the admissions office sit-in necessary to get things to where they got? And I don't know how you would conclusively come anywhere near being able to answer that question conclusively. But that's not the only question which I think reasonably bears on the question of, was the Black student sit-in a good idea? Because this kind of stuff, student activism was going on all over the country, and the SAS students felt, and I think very understandably, that they wanted to be solidary with this. You see?
And what about the relation of black activism and then all the other activism like Vietnam War and women's activism.
Yeah, let me share an opinion with you on that, John. I thought there was, we could say there was black activism and white student activism. And I frankly, at least just at Swarthmore, I don't have firsthand experience, any significant amount of firsthand experience with this anyplace else. Black student activism was much more constructively conducted, much more sensibly conducted, much better reasoned than was white student activism. This doesn't have to do at all, in my thinking, with the importance with comparing and rating, rank ordering the worthiness of the causes that were espoused by the two different activisms. It had to do, among other things, with practicality. The black student activists say, okay, we want a black studies program. Okay? That we want a significant number of black students so there can be a viable black community on campus. That we want black faculty members, black administrators. Their goals were specific, they were empirical, they were practical, they were immediate, they were in principle realizable, although maybe the college would decide to undertake some and not others. Where white student activism so often tended to be on the order that we're not going to stop disrupting college life until American troops get out of Cambodia. I mean, literally. Mm-hmm. That there's just a total disconnect between what so often between what the white student activists were actually doing on campus and what goals they said they were trying to foster. Mm-hmm. The black students all pretty much always, of course they wanted to, you know, diminish or eliminate racism, and but they didn't expect Swarthmore to diminish or eliminate racism, you know, in the American world. They always were looking at proximal, concrete, practical, attainable things which would move the situation in a good direction. And white student activism was often, so global. And, I mean, what they were doing was real specific. You know, and white student activism in the aggregate over a 3-4-5 year period was significantly more disruptive of the normal life of the college than was the black student activism associated with the admissions office business.
And yeah, an interesting point that comes up a lot is that the black student activism was often described as militant.
Yeah,
that seems to come up a lot.
There's a real problem here with what adjectives we like. And talking to one person who was involved in black student activism, this person made a big point of saying we were completely nonviolent, and that is true, which was not true for every other campus in the country. Mm-hmm. I mean, at Cornell, the black students were in whatever building they were in with guns. Mm-hmm. You know, that's true. It's completely nonviolent, but it was definitely coercive, and it was definitely confrontational. Shortly before he died, when all of these, you know, thousand students gathered over there and Clothier and faculty there and making speeches and one thing and another. And I guess Courtney Smith was asked to come, and he said a few brief words to the assembly. Do you have any sense? I never knew Courtney. I met him in just a couple times very briefly. I never had any significant association with him. But he was quiet, he was unobtrusive. Very, very serious. In some respects, I don't think he was he certainly wasn't socially a glad-hander or glib or anything like that. He got up in front of the assembled multitudes and just quietly said, no leading, he says, we have lost something precious. And I'm pretty sure he didn't say what it was that the college had lost, but I'm pretty sure that what he meant is the college had lost its commitment to treating with each other non-coercively, non-antagonistically, non-confrontationally. And it had, no question about it. Because although the black student activism was definitely nonviolent, and in fact, in my experience, and what experience I personally had from the much more that I heard about, the black students were generally quite polite. I mean, even when they went to the admissions office and got everybody who was in there out, they were very polite about it. You know, would you please come with me? While they were in the admissions office, they kept it neat as a pin. You know? And just in conversing with, even when disagreement was strong, they were not impolite. You see? Not impolite face to face. You see? And the same can't be said for a lot of the white students.
And had the faculty respond to that after the sit-in?
I thought the faculty, over, we're talking about a very long period.
I guess more directly after.
Well, we're talking about a period. So I thought the faculty overall behaved well. Kept its eye on the ball, tried to identify important issues, and then mobilize our distinctively Swarthmore resources, some of which, of course, were money, you know. But some of which were the ability that Swarthmoreans seemed to have to communicate well and effectively with each other in a mutually accepting and affirmative way, even when we disagree.
Mm-hmm.
You see? And let's keep trying to deal with it that way. Let's keep trying to deal with it that way. You see?
And it seemed that part of that was directly after the sit-in the faculty undertook sketching up plans for, I think, what they called crisis situations and handling
that.
Yeah,
but nothing came of that. Part of that, I think, now I'm slipping under my anthropological hat now, part of that was like funerary practices in a number of cultures. Courtney Smith's death was a blow. I mean, a numbing. That in itself did not disrupt the operations of the college. The administration just closed ranks. You know who Ed Kratzley was?
Was he the vice president?
Well, he was vice president in charge of finance, but he was senior vice president, so he became acting president for the year and a half or so it took to get a replacement for Courtney Smith. And he did a superb job. Susan Cobbs, who had been dean of students, was not elevated in title, but who was very highly thought of in the faculty and in the college. She and Ed Kratzley sort of were the triumvirate. And they did a superb job. I mean, the college stayed on track. But we wanted, so many people in the college, the wish was so intense to undo the tragic loss, you see, and writing, we will never let this happen again, kinds of manifestos. You see, of course, part of the thing that was behind this was that, well, if the black students hadn't been in the admissions office, Courtney Smith wouldn't have suffered a fatal heart attack. And again, it's understandable that such sentiments would emerge, but that's just 100% wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, he clearly had coronary artery disease.
Yeah.
You know, he was a young man. He was in his early 50s. It's understandable that such sentiments emerge, especially in a tight-knit community, you know. And you even heard, no one would say it out loud, but you even heard newspapers like the Delaware County Times, which is not one of the paragons of American journalism, in my experience. I don't know if you ever looked at it. would report, you know, that there are stories that's worth one of the people are saying that the black students killed Courtney Smith. I never heard that said at Swarthmore. Mm-hmm. You know. But there were things like Lee Bramson, the chair of our department. He wrote a manifesto which never saw the light of day, happily. That we have lost a beloved leader and we must never let anything like this happen again. Mm-hmm. And Lee was very devoted to Courtney Smith. He'd worked very closely with Courtney Smith. Courtney Smith had been very helpful to the new department and to Lee and very encouraging and supportive. You know, and Lee had lost a parent surrogate. Yeah. You know, so we'll somehow make it up to Courtney by solemnly swearing we will never let anything like this happen again. But nothing ever came of any of that kind of sentiment surfacing in that kind of situation is not surprising. The noteworthy thing is not that some of that kind of sentiment surfaced, but that nothing came of it. Mm-hmm. And the college collectively had the good sense not to try to walk down that road. You see.
And then so by the time, a year or two later, when you've got the committee organized for establishing black studies, and you as a faculty member reaching out to other faculty members to work with them,
mm-hmm.
did you have the sense that they were pretty receptive of your goals?
Yes. Now, when you say reaching out, the membership of the committee was not set by me.
Okay.
The membership of committees at Swarthmore is set administratively. You see, and how does which students get on? But CS said who the black students were going to be. Mm-hmm. See, I think more recent kind of student council says which students will be on which committee. So the membership of the committee was certainly not set by me. It was set administratively. But yes, I've never had an experience at Swarthmore working with people who are outside of my immediate bailiwick. My immediate bailiwick is the Socianthro department. That wasn't a positive experience. People be as helpful as they could, which does not preclude disagreement, but disagreement will be conducted in a constructive, amicable, mutually accepting, affirmative manner, you know. But basically, when a committee is set up to recommend the program, the committee is going to guide its own work, you see. And for something like Black Studies, which is heavily interdisciplinary, that does involve a lot of outreach to different departments. You see? Mm-hmm. Okay. How is the history department going to get a black faculty member?
Mm-hmm.
See, got to go talk to the history department about
that. So you really did have to be in contact with a lot of the college in that process.
Yeah, but this kind of being in contact as the situation indicates it's a good idea. An awful lot of this goes on at Swarthmore. The process is done very well at Swarthmore. This is one of the real strengths of Swarthmore. So this did not just appear. This is part of the atmosphere at Swarthmore. This kind of process works well. Generally, you expect it to work well at Swarthmore. Mm-hmm. If you ask me to think of an example where it worked really badly, I don't think off the top of my head I could think of an example.
And what kind of relationship did you develop with the students, particularly like from SAS that were on that committee with you?
Well, I thought we worked well together. Like with students on other committees that I've been on, just by virtue of being on the committee, I didn't get to know them well at all. With reference to anything that went on outside the committee. Mm-hmm. You don't expect to. Probably the one that I got to know best, and best in this case as far as student-faculty relations go, was pretty well, was Don Mizell. But that was in very important part because he was a major in our department, and the two profs in our department he worked with most closely were Osmar Amlagese and myself. You see, so you might say Don and I had a lot of money in the bank independent of the committee. Mm-hmm. You know, had a lot of experience with each other independent of the committee. But you don't generally expect being on a committee with students, unless you know the student independent of the committee, you don't expect much by way of student faculty. Other than the work of the committee, you don't expect much by way of student faculty relationship to develop, mm-hmm. just by virtue of the fact you're on the committee together.
Yeah. And one thing I was interested about was that it seemed, looking over the documents on the creation of the Black Studies, especially planning out the curriculum, I guess part of it is that it's interdisciplinary, but it seems that there's a lot more creativity and kind of new structures going on with the plan of that than have been present in other majors and other programs.
Well, remember, majors are disciplinary. Mm-hmm. And there's one other thing I should say about the difference between majors and these interdisciplinary programs. Majors, departments, I should say, between departments and these interdisciplinary programs. Departments exist at a much higher, more solid level of institutionalization than these programs do, for the simple reason that all faculty appointments are within departments. There are no appointments in these programs, or virtually none. Mm-hmm. Like, say, Lee Smithy officially is half-time socianthro and half-time peace and conflict resolution. But I can't think of anyone else. I mean, Clem Cottingham was both, he was a political scientist. He was in the political science department. That's how it's been with all of these interdisciplinary programs. You see, and all of the faculty members who participate in interdisciplinary programs, they have full-time professional responsibilities other than the interdisciplinary program. So it's a labor of love, mm-hmm. you see. What was the question?
How much creativity it seems.
There seemed like there was a tremendous amount of creativity when the Black Studies program was created. But that, it seeming to be that way, it wouldn't seem so now. It seeming to be that way was, I think, in significant part an artifact of the fact that the Black Studies program was the first of these. So this was a new beast wandering around in the woods. Now the college got 8 or 10 of these interdisciplinary programs on the books. Yeah, it's been a long time since this was a new beast. We're used to them. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't seem as novel and as unconventional as it did in 1969, 70, 71, 72.
And I was kind of curious in stuff like the fieldwork requirement or recommendation. It seemed that a lot of discussion was that for some period, some part of the program should be this Black Studies.
Yeah, but again, you see, if you look at the college, if you look at student programs of study now, you'll see that in many, many of these programs, both during the academic year and over the summers, doing primary work with people of a research or applied sort is a part of the program. Look at you. Mm-hmm. Okay? You're just a freshman. That is, you. So far, you haven't been anything other than a freshman, but you'll outgrow that. Back in 1970, it was very unusual for primary research with people. So again, Black Studies was one of the first. The Socianthro Department was also one of the first to push this. But back then, it was very unusual and very unconventional in the college, in the college curriculum and in students' programs of study.
So do you think that was due more to the fact of when it was created versus the field that it was necessary for Black Studies?
Well, nowadays, you look at, I mean, I've been very much involved, actually, in this business of primary work with people as part of students' programs of study. It's partly in connection with my departmental stuff at Swarthmore, especially in connection with foreign studies stuff I did. There are a large number of departments now which strongly recommend, if they don't require primary work with people as part of the major. Okay? Socianthro, education, linguistics, Religion likes it a whole lot. Some of the area programs, Asian Studies, Latin American Studies, they push it real hard. You see, Black Studies was one of the leaders in this. And it made good sense for how Black Studies was coming to be conceptualized back then. But the college has substantially signed on with this. No, some departments don't do any of it, of course. But I'm not sure we expect physicists to, as part of the major. Although even there, what's her name? Who was the, oh God, it's so much embarrassing because I participated in her course. She was chair of the department for, who's the woman, who I think? She taught a course in the physics department. It wasn't required for the major, but about this issue, which especially in the physics department has been from time to time a vexing issue, women in physics. You see? And we knew each other anyway and talked a lot. And I sort of got rung in to work with the class and with her on how you would develop some primary research with people that would throw light on how women think about whether they want to study physics or not. Because so few women do.
And also a little bit on the development of the program.
Excuse me?
A little bit more on the development of the program. It seemed that some of the students that graduated like in 1969 got some kind of distinction as Black Studies, not major, but like a specialization.
I don't know exactly what that was, but especially back then. But I think now for graduates, the two large-scale batches of honorifics conferred by the college, one for honor students, which is honors, and what degree of honors? Honors, high honors, highest honors. Okay, and the other for course students, which is distinction in course. And then there's a few special awards given to seniors, but they're very few in number. Whether this was some variant of that, I don't know. I just don't know.
So there wasn't really much of a Black Studies program before that.
Before when?
Before, I guess, like 1969, 1970.
Well, I think you could say there was no Black Studies program before 19. I'm pretty sure the faculty approved the program proposed by Frank Pearson's committee in the fall semester of 69. Okay, so that was the first Black Studies program, the first real Black Studies program at Swarthmore, I believe.
And before that, there were some classes that kind of individually addressed issues,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
but nothing cohesive.
Nothing cohesive. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah. You see, and again, coming back to, well, was the admissions office, for the Black students' purposes, was the admissions office sit-in really necessary? Because so much progress, a lot of progress really already had been made. The college was conscientiously, faithfully, really working on this, devoting all the time, effort, and attention to this. You know, if some part of the purpose of the Black students was to produce this herd effect nationwide, then yes, the admissions office sit-in was a good idea because the Swarthmore's Black students joined with the nationwide wave of activism. See, they participated in that.
And you've mentioned a little bit about the herd effect of the colleges and universities establishing Black Studies programs. How much did that influence Swarthmore's?
Well, there is just incredible competition for faculty and students to black faculty, black students, because, you know, the demand was so great and supply was so small. I mean, you don't have to, you know, have a PhD in economics to see how that flows. I wasn't aware of any nastiness in there. Oh, but you see, this created an entrepreneurial niche for a few black academics. They became what other black academics called revolving door scholars. They would hold full-time academic positions at maybe three or four different places, get full salaries at three or four different places. So each of these three or four different places could list them as black faculty members. In other words, there wasn't much of that, but it got noticed. I mean, there wasn't much of that. But you know, I mean, if you wanted to line your pockets, and if you were a black with a PhD, you could do that.
There's definitely the demand.
The demand for that, you know, the niche was there.
And it seemed one suggestion for bringing in faculty at one point was either designing programs where students could work with other colleges, or designing loan programs where professors would come on loan. Did that ever develop?
Well, early on, you know, there's a couple black colleges or universities in the neighborhood of Swarthmore, Cheney State and Lincoln. And one of the ideas that definitely surfaced when this pressing, urgent question of where are we going to get black faculty members arose was, well, maybe we can borrow them from Lincoln and Cheney. Maybe they can come on exchange or something.
But nothing really came of that.
Nothing really came of that. Not that I know of.
Do you know why, or just...
My guess is that the credential level of the faculty, this is just a guess. I was never involved in this. I mean, it was discussed in the Black Studies Committee when I was on it, but I was never involved in administrative deliberations about should we do this or should we not do this. The credential level of faculty members at Cheney State and Lincoln was not thought to be adequate.
And would the same be said for having students go on, take classes there?
There was a bit of that, but I think not so much Cheney State and Lincoln, but two or three of the southern black schools. Mm-hmm. What's the one in Atlanta?
What is it? It is... forgetting it now.
You know who Fred Pryor was? You read about
that?
He was in the economics department about my seniority. Fred and I knew each other well for a long time. Fred was independently wealthy, or his family was anyhow. I think it was Singer Sewing Machine money. And Fred was very involved in working with black southern colleges. He was on the board of managers of a couple, raised money for them, helped them with curricular development. He was very committed to that. But I'm not sure that any student, I don't remember for sure.
Is Morehouse the college?
Morehouse, yeah. Morehouse in Atlanta. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was one discussed for doing like an exchange program.
Yeah, and there was an exchange program for a while with at least one southern black school, I believe. I wasn't involved in that. That doesn't signify any opinion on my part about whether it was a good idea or not. It's just outside of my bailiwick. The natural run of things, I would not have been working on that.
And was that part of like the Black Studies program, or was that just kind of more of like a...
Well, my guess is
changing
like
a view.
Like with foreign study more recently, you know, I mean, suppose it turns out you do major in history, and suppose you go and do foreign study at Oxford University in England, just about certainly you'll take a couple history tutorials over there and you'll get credit from the history department towards completion of your history major for them. So, like that.
Okay. So the idea is if you go to these black colleges and take
the
classes
there, transfer the credit back and whatever department accepts the credit. If it's your major, the credit counts towards the 32 you need for the degree, and maybe it will help you with some other requirement for the degree, such as major. I don't know whether it could help with this, whether for distribution requirement they have to be courses taken at Swarthmore, or whether you can count transfer credit. I just don't remember. But you ask Martin Warner that, he'll know. He will certainly know.
And how much of the designing of their curriculum and that type of planning was borrowed from other schools or was discussed?
Well, certainly the people who were working on developing the curriculum were paying a lot of attention to what was going on at other schools. How much was actually borrowed? Remember we talked about the two different stages in which departments are invented? How much was actually borrowed was determined by the people who were doing the second stage invention.
So it's hard for you to say, but because
But you see, Black Studies is like any other... Have you heard the expression university without walls?
No.
Well, I was employed by Swarthmore College, Swarthmore College and University with walls. There, I'm a Swarthmore College faculty member. But I had my broader network of people on all other planes. I was connected to the profession, and I read journals, and I participate in projects with faculty members from other schools. So I learn a lot about what's going on in the profession at other schools in ways which I'm often not entirely self-conscious of. It influences what I do at Swarthmore. No less so for Black Studies. Black Studies is just like any other field at Swarthmore in that respect.
One thing I came across reading through some papers was the Danforth Foundation. Is that something you remember?
Yes, there's a report here.
Is that the kind of thing that
that's the kind of thing people pay a lot of attention to at Swarthmore. Also, I neglected to mention, you know who James Michener was? The author? He's a Swarthmore grad. He gives a lot of money to Swarthmore. Sometime in the earlier mid-70s, he decided he was going to give a little money to support Black Studies curricular development. So a faculty member, initially a part-time faculty member, James Michener, perhaps because he's a literary person, are you familiar with the sociolinguistic expression Black English vernacular?
Not really.
That's a dialect of English that's spoken in the ghetto, you know, just like redneck mushmouth is the dialect of English that's spoken back up in the hollers in Appalachia, you know, and who knows what they call what's spoken in Philadelphia. Black English vernacular are real important to the lives of an awful lot of Black people. The BEV is what's usually referred to. So Michener said there should be a course in the curriculum on BEV. Now, who's going to teach such a course? It would be a sociolinguist. So Michener gave money to hire such a person. That person subsequently, it's interesting how this develops. It turns out at that time and for a long time after, probably the number one sociolinguist in the country was a man named William LaBove, who was at Penn, not in a department, but in an interdisciplinary program called the Center for Urban Ethnography. And LaBove specialized in BEV. Well, Michener gave enough money to buy one course. Now, you're not going to run a nationwide search to buy one course. You're going to go hire a good-looking senior graduate student. See, it happened, and the administration decided, well, a sociolinguist will be in the social department. Now, this was a little bit after the period we're talking about, because I was chair of the department then. So whoever was provost, and it was probably Harry Wright. You know who Harrison Wright is?
No.
He was chair of the history department then. Okay. During this period, he's a South Africanist by profession, was very much involved in this stuff. And you'll find a number of documents in here by Harry Wright. Anything you find by Harry Wright, you should read carefully. Not that I always agreed with him, by no means. But Harry Wright was just an exceedingly reasonable person. He just reasons terribly, terribly well. So if he has put pen to paper for some issue that you're interested in, reading what he has to say is going to help you in your thinking. You may not wind up agreeing with him, but he's going to help you an awful lot. So he became provost, and he called me and said, Steve Groton, and he said, in fact, Steve Groton, get us, you know, buy one course from Associate on BEV. Okay. So I said, well, you know, you're not going to run a nationwide search to bring in a faculty member to teach one course. No faculty, you know. So I called LaBove. And yeah, I'd love to come on down. We can talk about it. And I says, well, here's I got the fellow you want. He's my best graduate student in a decade. You know, John Baugh. So John came out and taught the course, and John was great. And he was in the department for a couple of years. He became full time. Never got on tenure track. You see, and that was one of these places. I remember he had a couple of disagreeing conversations with the provost to the following effect. Look, you say you want to significantly increase the number of qualified black faculty members. Okay, here we have John Baugh, who presently, just at the beginning of his career, says he wants to stay at Swarthmore and have a lot of his career at Swarthmore. John Baugh is black. He's going to be at the forefront of his profession in 15 years. He specializes in BEV, which could be the core subject matter for a black studies program. Figure out some way to create a slot for him. See, he would have stayed. I'm not sure he would have stayed for his whole life, but he would have stayed for a while. Mm-hmm. But they didn't do it. Said, no, we can't do it.
Mm. Were there other situations like that?
Very few, because there are very few John Baughs in the world. I mean, but personally and professionally, he was truly outstanding. And within 10 or 15 years, he was at the pinnacle of the profession. Of the sociolinguistics profession. But I don't think I ever met James Bishop. No reason I should ever have met him. But that was John Baugh made a this was anyhow 4 or 5 years after I chaired the Black Studies Committee.
Okay.
But he made a very significant and decisive contribution to the early years of the Black Studies program. I mean, he was what you wanted a half a dozen of.
Mm-hmm. So. And you said stuff like the Danforth Foundation were important.
What they wrote?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the kind of stuff that the people in the college pay attention to.
Yeah.
Yeah. They pay attention to that. But you see, it's never supposed that Swarthmore, when they were developing new programs, they devote a lot of attention to relevant stuff that's going on at other schools. But devoting a lot of attention to relevant stuff that's going on at other schools is a far cry from supposing is what's going on at other schools is going to be a model for what's going to happen at Swarthmore. It almost never plays that way. Mm.
Let's see if we have anything else to discuss. I guess, were there any people in particular that you haven't mentioned that really played an important or positive role?
Yeah, there's one we haven't mentioned that played a very important negative role.
Okay.
You know who Fred Hargadon was?
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen this letter? This is from CS students. This was December 16th, 1968, which means right on the eve of the admissions office sit-in. This was from CS students to John Van Til, because John Van Til was a member of the Black Studies Curriculum Committee who they were in close touch with. This letter is about Fred Hargadon. This letter is 100% accurate on Fred Hargadon. So, he was a director of admissions. In some senses, I knew him a bit. He was a very public figure, very capable, a very good administrator. I think he was very devoted to students, but in a traditional paternalistic manner. And he had just a wildly overblown ego. And he so needlessly alienated the black students. Just read that paragraph. He sent that to student council after student council endorsed some of CS's positions. I mean, that's the petulant cry of a spoiled child.
Mm-hmm.
You can take that.
Yeah.
Well, I'll give you all this stuff if you want. Or if you prefer, your traveling light, if you prefer, I'll mail it down to you.
We can discuss it later and see if it makes sense.
Would you prefer that? Or if you want to take it, you can just take it.
I'll just see how things fit.
I can give you a little handbag to carry it in if you want.
Could work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll keep this with you. But this, I remember Hargadon very well in how he played his hand in this thing. And this letter characterizes him down to the dotting of the I's and the crossing of the T's. And it's very, this letter is very unflattering to him. So, but that was Fred Hargadon.
So how would you and other faculty members work around that, considering he was...
Well, he stopped being director of admissions after about a year or 2 years. He was a very good... You see, the director of admissions is one of the... The admissions office is one of the few offices in Swarthmore where there are highly measurable, quantifiable criteria for success. And he was very successful. He recruited very good classes. So,
and he ended up moving on to Stanford...
He went to Stanford and then Princeton, or was it Princeton and then Stanford? He became director of admissions at Stanford.
Princeton, but
yeah.
Do you think he kind of felt the pressure that he needed to get out of Swarthmore?
I have no idea. That's not something that would be discussed. We didn't know each other in such a way that he would ever discuss something like that with me. So I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Courtney Smith was very high on Fred Hargadon. He had vast capability, but I think part of the problem, and he was very devoted to students, but it was this traditional paternalistic manner. He'd get to know students during the admissions process. He'd stay in touch with them after they came, but he thought he could sort of direct their lives. And up until the earlier mid-60s, this kind of paternalistic, caring posture towards undergraduates was very much appreciated by undergraduates. Hargadon befriended them, but he expected them to follow his suggestions, you see. Hargadon, like just about all of us, was not a man for all seasons, and the season changed. And this kind of paternalism was no longer welcome. That was part of the problem. The other part of the problem was his overblown ego. I mean, that guy, he was an egomaniac. He had such a high opinion of himself. I thought he was, if there was a villain in this piece, it's Fred Hargadon. Now, don't quote me to that effect in anything you write. And I guess you're going to have to deal with the question when you guys write this up. There's a whole mass of correspondence and intramural memos and whatnot in here. None of it was intended for publication, or almost none of it. You'll see a little of it was. How you're going to be able to capitalize on the contents of what's here without getting into some ethical hot water.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
That's your problem. That's not my problem.
Yeah. And were there any people that on the other end were exceptionally helpful that you haven't already mentioned?
I don't think Osmaram Lagesa's helpfulness can be overrated. Oh, and Catherine Morgan also.
Can you talk a little bit about how she comes into the picture?
Well, recruiting black faculty members. Now, she was recruited to the history department. Strictly speaking, I don't believe she's a historian. She's a folklorist. You see? And then this special bond, I knew Catherine a bit. This special bond, which was very strong and very positive, developed between Catherine and most or all of the black students. She had a vast, she had no authority over any of them, and never thought that she did, unlike Fred Hargadon, who, he didn't think that he actually, he had licensed authority, but he thought that he could direct them. See, I don't think Catherine ever thought that, but she had vast influence with the black students. You know, I think no one's stature was higher than Catherine's in the eyes of the black students.
In what year was it that she came on board?
Early 70, 71, 72 maybe.
I'm sure that's listed somewhere.
That you can find that out. Oh, one thing I mentioned, there's a few other people who are, I think, still standing, who were there then, and who were very, at least, and who were very, some of whom were very involved in this stuff. I'm pretty sure Harry Wright is still alive. If he is, it would be a wonderful thing if someone could be in touch with him the way you're in touch with me.
All
right. Hans Oberdieck, who is still, you know Hans Oberdieck in philosophy, you know who he is? He was there then. Yeah, he's actually a few years senior to me, because he had been there for 2 or 3 years by the time I got there. Who else? Gene Klotz, mathematician. Now, he's retired, but I'm pretty sure he's still around someplace. Jenny Keith, a longtime close friend and colleague of mine. She joined the department in 67, a year after I did. We were together in the department forever, close friends. She's a distinguished anthropologist. She was provost of the college for 10 years. She's retired now, but she's down in Delaware somewhere with her husband. All these people just go to the provost office. They'll know how to... The history department, if Harry Wright is still alive, the history department will know how to reach him. Go, who's chair of history now? You know?
I think Professor Burke.
Yeah, go ask Tim. He'll know how to reach him. Hans Oberdieck is just there in the philosophy department. I don't know if he's there this summer, but... Jenny Keith would also be a very good person, because also women's issues, the stew, the broth, all the stuff, racial issues, Vietnam War issues, poverty, gay issues, he hadn't really got onto the front burner yet. Women's issues. Jenny was especially, she was a leader of in moving the college towards a better situation with women's issues. So it would be real good to talk to Jenny. So I'm back to figuring out uses of your time.
Well, I guess just the last thing is, if there's anything that you'd like to add that I haven't asked you yet that you feel it's important to
add? Well, you know, I think I will think on this. It's been a very stimulating time we've spent together, John. I will think on this. I'm not, right now off the top of my head, I'm not thinking of anything, but if over the by tomorrow morning or the next few days, I know how to reach you and I'll just send it to you.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right.